Welcome back to Irish Illustrated Insider. It is Thursday, September 10th. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined by Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated, Pete Samsey of The Athletic, John Bryce of USA Today. And it is the Rice preview, which means we'll be taking a lot of questions on Wisconsin in the future. Most likely during this, Notre Dame, 44.5 point favorite over Rice, 55.5 over under. Rice's defense is awful. They do run the form of the option, which will be fun to watch. I had our Rice insider on. He was asking me what Notre Dame has done against the option in the past. And I said, well, there's a problem for Rice. They practice against it all year long because of Navy. So I think they will be able to adapt to this short week. Guys, I want to go back quickly to, we're still a little bit off on this short week because we had Juno Gadooley, four players yesterday, Marcus Freeman today. And yesterday's interview is more revealing than today for Freeman, as you would expect for the Rice preview.
Yeah, you know, I mean, their offensive attack is, it's a little bit different. We're accustomed to the fullback dive, and they don't have a fullback. They're in the pistol. They have two slot backs like normal. They don't want to throw it. They only threw it 10 times the other day, although they gained a substantial lead early on. But it's, you know, it's a little bit different. Their quarterback, Ja'Kari Brown, is a really, really good athlete, 6'4", 227. You'll see what a quality athlete he is. Don't ask him to throw it because that's not his skill set. He's made three stops, Miami, Central Florida, and now Rice, and he's rushed for as many yards as he's passed it. So that's where it can be a little bit problematic, although Notre Dame, you know, prepares for it because of Navy. But it's on the defensive side of the ball that Rice is going to run into a whole lot of trouble, I would imagine, this Saturday afternoon.
We talked to Juno Gadooley and the players yesterday and felt bad for Gadooley at one point. You know, Gadooley's father passed away at the end of last week, as did Don Shuler's, of course, more heavily publicized. And Coach Gadooley was obviously choking up talking about the influence he had in his life. I thought the best thing he said was kind of shaped him for his career as a football player, being in his dad's boxing gym when he was 11 and taking medicine balls to the face from Division I athletes and playing basketball against Danny Fortson when he was 11 years old. He said, all of a sudden, this stuff didn't faze me. And I think that's what they've tried to instill a little bit in Notre Dame. I love talking to the coaches because you get a breakdown of what truly matters. I thought we might be getting coach speak from Marcus Freeman when I asked him about the constant checkdowns. But Pete Sampson, Juno Gadooley said, the patience to do that was the most impressive thing I can tell you about CJ Carr. The fact that he could throw a ball away. He didn't used to be able to throw a ball away. He's just grown by leaps and bounds. And that's who matters, not us.
Yeah, I thought the breakdown of the first pass that was incomplete to Faison. I mean, we're in there talking to Gadooley about an incompletion, a sort of misread by Aeneas Williams on a route concept, and a run check. That's sort of where we are with CJ Carr at this point. And that's, you know, I kind of followed up with Freeman today. I think, T.O., you kind of got to this on Tuesday about, like, you know, game plans and the way Carr executed. And I do think there's a time where you got to force the issue a little bit more than what they did. But Freeman's point today was just like, if it's working, then you don't need to dictate because you're just letting, you're letting the defense make the game plan for you. And that's the easiest way to go. So I thought that Carr was, I don't know if it'd be a memorable performance of CJ Carr. Like, nobody ever won the Heisman Trophy based off a run check, but you know, I thought it was a mature old performance from Carr. And like, if they get that, let me put it this way. If they get that in the nine games, excluding BYU, Miami, and SMU, they will cruise to 9-0. There won't even be a question of, you know, winning by double digits, if not 20 points plus in all of those games.
And I would just say, like, when did CJ Carr get in trouble last year? It's when he forced the football. So the maturity there ultimately makes the offense more dangerous, because the more he shows a willingness to check down, the more that becomes something that creeps into the mind of the defense. And then maybe it does open up some more shots over the top. So I think that's a critical step. I think we know last year, Texas A&M comes to mind with him forcing the ball. USC comes to mind. Obviously, they still handled USC, but those are the moments that come to mind to me. So I thought it was a very poised performance from CJ Carr.
Priester, we spoke with Anthony Knapp, who the first time we ever talked to him, when he was probably late February of his early enrollee freshman year, he was the best guy to talk to that day, and he continues to be that way. I don't know if we can fully explain the humor involved of Anthony Knapp not playing basketball, but it did include the word violence, and people like to hear about that.
he really has become very engaging. And I think, you know, when you sit around a table with him like that, I know he doesn't have the captain designation, but clearly he's a captain on this team. But yeah, he was talking about his high school offensive line coach who differentiated between the what basketball is and what football is. And he said, no disrespect to basketball, but you know, basketball players are physical and football players are violent. And that's the way that he likes to play the game. And I thought he was, you know, we talked about this earlier in the week, and we don't, you know, you're sitting in a press box and you're trying to watch a million things, and you have to see the replay of the game. And I thought he was sensational. I thought Ashton Craig had a really good game too, but the transition to him at offensive guard is seamless, and at least it was the other night. And you know, the whole talk about Bloody Tuesday and being in pads, I mean, he couldn't have been, like, he was pretty indifferent to the whole idea of them going in pads for less than 48 hours after a game, because he said, we know we need to do that. And he's an offensive lineman. I mean, he's geared to think that way. But I don't really think, you know, Marcus Freeman gave that a lot of thought. And today I asked him about, you know, would you have done that if you were playing a conventional offense this week? And or is it a game two thing since you've struggled with that? And he said, we probably would have done it anyway. But when you're playing triple option football with some different principles than what you're accustomed to with Navy, they had to be in pads to get some things accomplished.
Well, I found it, I kind of said to Nolan James, it felt like a nothing burger a little bit to me because it's game two. I wouldn't think they would get out of pads other than the short week, but Nolan James was like, yeah, it was game. I didn't feel a single different thing going into this practice. We have to be in pads. I think game seven, you better not have a short week after game
different,
seven.
No, different.
Go pads, but after week two, I mean, you gotta have some normalcy, and they scaled it back a little bit. And yeah. I think it's
much different situation at that time of the year, no doubt.
We also spoke with Jaden Osbury, and the question I know he's used to the option at this point, but I kind of wanted to ask him, what was it like when you weren't? Because as a freshman, he didn't even get to see it. He was a scout teamer at the time, and then his first year preparing for it, he's like, yeah, it was exceptionally difficult. He said the first time he saw it in the spring, he had no idea what was going on, but by the end of August camp, he had dialed in a little bit more. And Pete, I think, shows how much they work on it. You know, like that amount of time going into a game that was 2024, they played in late October, right? Navy. So that's how much time they work ahead on things in some form, scout team version to prepare for those things. Of course, they had two teams that year, just like this year. They had Army.
Yeah, it's I feel like they've had a good beat on the option for quite a while now. You know, going back to toward the tail end of Brian Kelly. And as I've said many times, and I'll just repeat it, when Notre Dame is really good, the option is not that hard to defend. When Notre Dame is bad, it's a real pain in the butt. Notre Dame is good, so defending the option shouldn't be that complicated.
And not just good, Notre Dame is really athletic on that side of the ball. And that obviously ties into what you're saying, Pete. And then on top of that, you have the coaches and the players doing football school, and the coaches devote time to every single opponent, to where months ago they were devoting 3 to 4 days of an entire week onto Rice preparation. And then that's passed on to the players, who then have the football school and can implement it in the PLP, the player led practices. So all of those things, you're no longer seeing Notre Dame with any sort of malaise about attacking the option. They're just able to do so.
I agree with you guys, but my one caveat is that junior Tui Alamaka and Josh Burnham were the defensive ends against Navy's option attack last year. Boubacar Traore was a healthy scratch. Marcus Freeman said he didn't recall exactly why, you know, he didn't play in that game. You know, and then you have Bryce Young as well, who has not shown, you know, a proclivity for playing against option football. So that's just one thing to keep an eye on. Notre Dame's defensive ends in this game have not had a lot of experience playing against it.
Priester, we touched on your Rice preview at the very top of this podcast, but I'll circle back. We don't want to put too much into Rice, but Rice's offense, we do have one question from PA Irish 5. One of the challenges of Navy's triple option was the pressure placed on the opponent to be efficient because they had limited possessions. Does Rice use a similar clock-draining approach, or will they move with a little bit more pace?
I think probably a little bit more pace, but still last year they were eighth in the country in time of possession. What hurts them compared to Navy is they were the bottom half of the country in yards per carry at 4.11. So they can't, or at least they couldn't last year, possess the football, you know, quite like Navy can do. But, you know, Rice threw it 224 times last year compared to 182 by Navy, played the same amount of games. I don't think that they're going to want to throw the football a whole lot against Notre Dame. They had the fifth most, Rice had the fifth most rushing attempts last year in the country. So it is very similar. I'm not sure that they're necessarily intent on bleeding the clock the way it feels like when you're playing the Naval Academy. But when you look at the numbers from last year, other than the disparity in yards per carry, it's a similar approach. And we talked about, you know, I mentioned no fullback, some variations there. I said to Osbury last night, I said, it looks like, you know, they come at the, like the entry points at the point of attack with their slot backs and running back is like a little bit of a different angle from Navy. He said, no, I don't think so. So what do I know?
I've known Rice coach Scott Abel since he was at Davidson and put that program on the map and did it when Davidson didn't really have scholarships or they were transitioning into just offering football scholarships. And he took that team to the playoffs with the same offense. It does have a little bit more tempo to it when it finds success. Otherwise, it can be very plodding. If they feel like they have you on your heels a little bit, they will try to speed the tempo up a little bit more. Scott Abel just always very stoic on the sidelines, but he's got some principles that he believes very strongly in. But that's their MO, and I don't think they're going to have the physicality to get Notre Dame on its heels whatsoever. They might crack a play here or there, but this is not a Navy team. This is not an Army team. This is a team that's going to get run right out of Notre Dame Stadium.
You know, what's interesting, Pete, is they've had such a good beat on this since 2017, but since 2017, the only time a Navy team threatened Notre Dame was when they started throwing like crazy against Al Golden in his first season while we were out in Baltimore. Was it 35-7? Hung on for 35-32?
Yeah, the cover zero game, if I remember.
Yes, yes. It was the Braden Lindsay catch of all time game, too, which you
didn't think. Yeah, that was good, too. Together.
All right, that's all I got for Navy. That's all I got for Rice for you guys. We'll be back with segment two, Burning Up the Boards. We are back with segment two. We call it Burning Up the Boards. Our first question is from both Packy P and Irish from A10, veteran podcast appearances. They have as many starts as Bowen and Gray, I think, combined here, guys. How much different would the perception of ND's performance be if you flipped the first and second half? In other words, if they started with three touchdown drives and a pick six, so we're up 28-3, but played Wisconsin about even in an ugly second half, 13-10. Would it change how you felt about the game? John Bryce.
Irish from A2, not A10. You misspoke there. Put some respect on his name. No, I like the way that Notre Dame won the game. I think that it's a more mature team that can break away from a first half slog and really put Wisconsin down with some malevolence there in the second half. And so I think there's no question in my mind that I like the way, like, yes, you want Notre Dame to see Notre Dame go out and dominate all four quarters, but I like the way that Notre Dame handled this game in the second half. And I'll reiterate, I'm not saying I agree with this, but I've had multiple Big Ten people tell me they think Wisconsin can win eight games this year. So if they do, they don't have the worst schedule in the Big Ten. If they win eight games, then at the end of October, if they're a 6-2 team or something like that, people are going to feel even better about this Wisconsin game.
I think the fan reaction would probably be a little bit more like lucid about just like, hey, where you're on. Once you get the doubt at halftime was the problem. That was what was annoying people. And I think that sort of clouded how people viewed the second half because they were so annoyed at halftime after the first two quarters. So I think it would change perception a little bit. I don't think it makes a bit of difference at all, but I do think from a perception point of view, I can get behind what Packy P and Irish from A2 are sort of intimating here, that, you know, how people process the game might be different if you flip the halves.
Well, neither one's ideal, obviously, but I think playing better at the end of the game matters more. I would disagree with that, Pete, from the standpoint that Notre Dame took control of the game and then physically handled Wisconsin deeper into the game. To me, you know, especially since it was the first half of the first game of the season, you can excuse that a little bit more. But then to be physically dominant in the fourth quarter and possess the football for almost 11 minutes and just, you know, pretty much run over them, I would prefer that it ended that way. Like I said, neither is ideal. But when you consider the success of the Wisconsin program, which I put some numbers in today's Thursday Thoughts since Barry Alvarez, like his third year. It's unbelievable. Even when he was AD, they were 172-61 with him as AD. It's a successful program. And for them to do that in the second half against a physical program like that, I'd prefer it that way.
I think you're both right. First half was boring, so people watched it and were annoyed. Did you have the feeling of, I waited 281 days for this offense? Like, that's what you were thinking when you're watching the first 30 minutes of that game. But yeah, as like from a coaching perspective and player perspective, you'd rather go impose your will in the second half. But I know what they're saying, though. If it was 28-3 and 13-10, we'd all be saying, oh, they didn't need to do anything. They just ran the clock out. They're totally fine. And I think wouldn't matter. They moved up anyway. But I do think that's what everybody would say. 28-3, they took control. They took their foot off the gas. Maybe that would be the complaint. They took their foot off the gas.
And it would be the complaint. You know that. You know that would be the complaint.
Yeah, that's true. Our next question from Nick Van Lysout. Notre Dame's passing attack on Sunday featured three of their running backs. That includes Keenan Young's catch in the right flat. Nolan James had the same number of receptions as Jordan Faison. Do you see the running backs being prominently featured in the passing game going forward? And is that actually sustainable in terms of their load management?
Prominently featured is overstating it, I think. I think you got to go back and look at Nolan James' catches, because three of the four were very specific down distance time situations. The first one was a 4-yard screen pass on 3rd and 16. It was like, we're just giving up the drive here. And the last two were with about 2 minutes left in the game where they're kind of just running out the clock. The other one was real nice, but even that was like kind of a check down. So I guess I would never describe a check down as, I would never equate check down and featured. Like those two, like check down is just when nothing else is open. Like, I think it's effective maneuver for this offense, but I don't think you would, you can't really feature a check down, I don't think.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying there, Pete. The great thing I think they have happening is that your top three running backs are all pretty adept at catching the football. And I don't think we did not realize that. I did not realize that necessarily going into the preseason with Keedron Young. We heard that that was the case. And then I think he showed it on that swing pass to him for 11 yards. I like the way he played. So yeah, Pete, you make a good point. I mean, those are check downs, and so maybe not, you know, featured, but all three of them have the capability. We know about Aeneas Williams. Nolan James said when he saw the DB turn his hips, he knew it was going to work, the quick out to him for the touchdown. So it's nice to have, and it's nice to get the football to the tight ends, albeit not to the extent that Eli Raridan averaging 15.1 yards per catch. Hey, he scored a touchdown last night, by the way, in the NFL, in his NFL debut. You don't have that until, you know, an Ian Premer or a Preston Frizzell gets involved with it athletically. But it's good to have. I think it's sustainable just getting the ball in their hands in the passing game, whether it's check down or whether you want to throw a swing pass to him, which I think we'll see moving forward. They're all capable of doing it, and that is helpful as you continue to try to find the components to surround Jordan Faison in the wide receiver room.
Yeah, this is coaching staff that really loves Nolan James and loves the versatility that he brings to the offense. And Pete has talked about it and written about it specifically. Like, this Notre Dame wide receiver core is a nice group. It's an upgrade over last year. It's not an elite college football wide receiver core, which means you've got to do some things to augment that in your throw game. And certainly Notre Dame's running backs present that ability. And I think, yeah, prominently featured, no, but I think it will continue to be something of a staple element of the offense. And you've got to love, like we've already seen Aeneas Williams do it as a true freshman, but you've got to think there's a rail route waiting for Nolan James where he's matched up on a linebacker and he's taking off down the left sideline for 40, 50, 60 yards.
Well, let me jump in. I would say that the impact of what happened is maybe your linebackers have to pay more attention to Nolan James and Aeneas Williams, and that opens things up for Micah Gilbert or Mylon Graham or Jordan Faison. Like, I don't think the fact that it's a threat is the big deal. How many stats they get, I don't think matters nearly as much.
Question number three from our good friend CMU Pens fan. The Sunday season opener fit your model of the first game as a sign of how the season will go. For instance, We felt the 2024 team could be special, and 2016, ooh, this could be a long season. T.O., the floor is yours.
Yeah. 2016 was a great model for this. This is actually Pete Sampson's longstanding theory, but 2016 is a really good model for how the season was going to go. It is probably the best one that you can get. You know, yeah, 2024 is pretty good. It was certainly a defense that was better than the offense. Run first team lacked passing game prowess, so that comes out as well. I mean, I guess technically it was 2025. I don't think so. They didn't give the ball to Jeremiah Love for an hour of game time, as JB likes to track. So it doesn't always work, but Pete, this is your theory, so I'll let you expand on if you think it fits. Certainly looks a lot like 24.
I think it fits incredibly well for this year, because I think all the things that we had a question about kind of popped up, and all the things we were certain about kind of look like we should have been certain about them the whole time, you know, from the kicker to the defense to CJ Carr's sort of processing. So I think that this is how this team's going to go. Like, is the offense going to be incredible with individual talent like Love and Price? Probably not. It's going to have to be sort of a sum of the parts situation. And we kind of saw that, including what we just talked about, Nolan James in the passing game. So, yeah, I think that what we saw on Sunday night will probably be some version of what we see the rest of the way. You know, can they improve that version a little bit? Sure. But I thought that the Wisconsin game probably is going to sum up quite nicely who Notre Dame is this year.
I know it comes off like we're harping on the whole wide receiver compliment to Jordan Faison. We get a lot of opportunities to harp. But until somebody steps forward, and, you know, Micah Gilbert stepped forward. I thought two of his three receptions, anybody can run a stop route and make those catches. His 18 yard in was impressive. But last year's team had Malachi Fields. He averaged 17.5 yards per reception. They've got to have that downfield threat. Again, we're not talking about, you know, winning games or qualifying for the playoffs. We're talking about making advancements in the playoffs, and they need that downfield threat from the boundary position. And I'm not sure Michael Gilbert's going to be that. So they're searching for that. I realize that, you know, it's a wide receiver room in progress. And until that happens, I think what Pete Sampson is saying is accurate.
And I would be terrible at my job, and some would contend that I am, but this was a two-part question, and I nearly missed part two from Bobby 1556. Is the worst thing about the first game of the year the overreactions? Pete Sampson, let us start with you.
No, I love the overreactions. We've waited, 9 months for a game? And the first game is 100% of the games. But hey, look, if Notre Dame wanted less overreactions, they could open up more practices and training camp. But that's so you get what you get. A lot of overreactions.
We waited a long time and we still overreacted because we were way overreacting to Notre Dame's situation right now, I think. You guys know who led Notre Dame in depth of target against Texas A&M in that great year they went to the championship game? What player?
Depth of target?
Yeah, it's the most important stat for wide receivers and tight ends and running backs, how deep you get. If you're looking at deep shots, you know who it was? That was Cooper Flanagan. So, you know, he was a pretty important guy in that run to the championship. Chris Mitchell was second with 9.
Chris Mitchell.
Faison was away at the end. Yeah, those guys are really important as we looked at week one of the season going into if they can win the championship game or not. So I don't know. I think we might be overreacting a little bit. I do like the fun theory, though, on game one modeling what might happen the rest of the way, because they won by 28 and we all predicted them to win by less than that.
I think we all overreact to some extent. I'll take ownership of that to some degree. But you know, like, our commentary isn't based upon one football game that we saw. It's based upon the practices that we get to see. It's based upon the feedback that we get. It's based upon the feedback we get in the summer. It's based upon the observations in the spring. It's based upon the feedback we get in the spring. You know, I don't think we're reacting to one game. We're reacting to a compilation of things over the course of months. But, you know, am I making too big of a deal about a compliment and now I'm saying it for the 100th time to Jordan Faison? Probably. The problem is you can't just, like, you know, like, it's just going to develop overnight. Mylon Graham has the athletic ability to develop that. When somebody says
30, he did have a 30-yard catch.
He did. 15-yard penalty. He did. And but, you know, when somebody says that Jaden Gracehouse doesn't scare the opposition? Well, no, he doesn't. And right now, that, you know, some of the best talent or the best athleticism is among the younger guys, and they're not in the mix yet. So overreaction or analysis, I think it depends upon the perception and where you're coming from.
The worst part of the opening game is the 9.5 month wait for it in this case, because Notre Dame should have been in the playoffs last year, but, and it wouldn't have been in a 9.5 month wait, but I digress.
Well, now, second was the jerseys.
Ooh.
The jerseys.
Samson just lobbing. I'm gonna check your time stamp on that grenade you just lobbed.
Yeah. Oh man, that was a rough. That
T.O. says, well, at least they have the names on the back. I say, hell, I can't read those either.
That was rough.
Yeah, sorry. I know some listeners are complaining about the glare of Priester and my glasses. Like, that's nothing compared to those jerseys, the glare off those numbers.
Tim knows, I'm sitting next to him. And I, for many years, I've watched games through binoculars. I would stare at a player through my binoculars. Is that 12 or 13? Like literally for 20 to 30 seconds, and they're turning, and the lights are shining really off of it, and I still wasn't sure who it was.
At one point, Driscoll and I were, he was four seats down, and Pete was like 10 seats down. So on the touchdown of Jaden Sanders, Driscoll and I were convinced that for some reason Aiden Pouncey was in the game. He was number 13.
I thought it was Leonard Moore.
And Pete thought it was Leonard Moore. I was like, well, that's not possible.
12, 13, 15.
Yes, I had no idea. But of course, it was the logical person, which it usually is.
We move on to question number four from Malloy on base. The Irish Illustrated podcast has repeatedly raised the question of why the staff keeps giving Sullivan Absher competition at his position as if they don't trust him. I'm no O-line coach, but he looked like a clear upgrade Sunday night. What am I not seeing?
I think you're not seeing practice.
Yeah.
You know, that's if Sullivan Absher practiced like he played on Sunday and Styles Prescott played like he practiced, then it would be that we'd have a different story. But so, like, sometimes players just surprise you in games.
Joe Otting last year.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that Sullivan Absher probably surprised the staff. Like, maybe he was motivated by the fact they keep throwing roadblocks in front of him, seemingly. So maybe he was a little bit healthier. I don't know. He was one of the players that thought about doing a Lambeau leap at the end and was like, yeah, I'm not doing this. But he did help up Sean Civilano, so I thought
that was nice. Yeah.
Future leader of the football team. But yeah, I just think the short answer is practice. I think Sullivan Absher probably overperformed his training camp.
Yeah, I would completely agree with what you said, Pete. Now he's positioned himself to maybe take hold of that job this week against Rice. And I would also give the coaching staff credit. We've seen them at a number of different positions be willing to make a switch when that's not necessarily the safe thing to do, but they made this switch and he rewarded them.
Okay. Now I would say that is, and I agree with you guys. I mean, and Pete, I thought you described it perfectly. But I think that's the exception to the, as a former coach, I take that as an exception to the rule because you have to adhere to what happens with your players on the practice field.
100%.
So, yeah, you know, all the credit to him and
Prescott started.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, and that's why, like, you know, I mean, I'm sitting there saying, good for you, Sullivan Absher. Way to show him. Now, why it took that long or when it took or what have you, I don't know. I can't answer those things. But he stepped forward, and then you hope that, okay, now you go back to the kid and say, look, this is what you can do. This is what you did. This is the standard we're going to hold you to, and we expect you to do it. And hopefully he'll do that. And, you know, I've had a lot of questions about, well, if Matty Augustine was better than him, why didn't they have him with the starters from the outset? Number one, we don't know how many snaps he took with the first team. Number two, Absher started the last five games last year, and I thought he did some really good things in November. So you want to give him, as the upperclassman, you want to give him the chance, especially early in camp when it's actually camp, you want to give him a chance to win the job. And we don't know exactly how many, you know, first team snaps Augustine took, probably not a ton, but Absher did a great job. And when Augustine comes back in 4 weeks, 5 weeks, whatever, I'm sure he'll give him competition once again.
Next question from VA Doc 88. Do you agree or disagree? Notre Dame has enough overall roster talent to win every game all the way through the college football playoff. let's make it a given that both teams involved in this will be playing without significant injuries. And that includes if there are turnovers in these games. In other words, you're not looking to play a perfect game to do this.
So basically, this is like, do you still believe Notre Dame can win a national title? That's the question.
That is the question. And, you know, obviously, you don't want to have injuries for, like, right. Ohio State's going to get a rash from the game. They're going to win.
Yes, I am unchanged in my opinion that Notre Dame can, and I'm not saying should win the whole thing, but, like, that's who I'd pick to win it.
Yeah, for me, I would put it as, I said preseason, I think Notre Dame can play for the national title, probably should be a top four seed that gets a bye. So I'm unchanged in thinking Notre Dame can play for the title. I do want to see more from the receivers.
You have to run the ball better, but you are going against a team and a program that stops the run. When the competition improves significantly, Miami, playoffs, what have you, SMU to some degree, we saw a little bit of that the other night. You have to prevent those explosives. You know, you can say they did the smart thing and check down, you know, the other night, and you don't want to force anything. Well, then why doesn't everybody run too high the entire year against CJ Carr? Is that what
they're going to?
Okay. All right. So is that what Notre Dame's offense is going to do every week because of that? You're going to have to
for a minute. Yeah.
I mean, you're going to have to force the issue somehow. And if not the middle of the field, which I understand you didn't want to throw to the middle of the field with those two guys back there, but you got to find a way to push the football down the field in the passing game. You can't just throw your hands up and say, oh, they're running that. We can't do that.
You know,
so I was going to say, I remember asking in spring ball, like, how do you think teams are going to defend Carr differently? And Gadooley was like, I don't think it'll be any different. Like, teams are going to try to stop the run first and take away the pass second. And I'm like, I'm not so sure about that.
I'm not sure he believed that, Pete.
Yeah, well, I mean, now that we've seen one game, again, I asked Carr about this post game. Like, I would play Notre Dame exactly the way Wisconsin played Notre Dame. I wouldn't load up to stop the run at all. I would keep two safeties back. So if you're Mike Denbrock and Gadooley and you put your heads together and be like, all right, what are some good beaters for that coverage? They've got a ton of them, but I think from moving forward, you dial into that kind of part, that part of the playbook a little bit more than maybe you did going into opening night. And that's fine. You know, offenses evolve over time and teams defend you differently. So you got to adapt as you go.
I mean, the running game has to be better or scarier for them to stop playing too high. You don't play too high against Jeremiah Love. You don't play.
No,
too
one team did it. It was terrible.
Yeah.
For them.
Exactly. You don't do that. So it's the running game that has to improve there. I do think they will. I mean, preseason, I don't change it all after week one because that would be silly unless it was 2007 Georgia Tech. I would say Notre Dame, Miami, and Georgia of the top seven teams have the easiest path to a top four seed because Georgia misses a lot of the best teams in the SEC and Notre Dame and Miami play each other. Apparently Notre Dame's got a harder schedule than Miami after watching Clemson, but maybe those things could change a little bit after week one as well. They won't be that bad. And then you have, like, you know, the Texas Tech, BYU. They don't even play each other, but BYU has to beat Notre Dame. So that's why I always said Notre Dame is semifinals or bust, because it should be winning one playoff game. If it's winning two, it's at home. So, yes, it should be that situation. I never, as I said, I'll take the field. I'm not taking Notre Dame, but if I had to pick a team, I'd pick either Notre Dame or Ohio State. That's why I ranked Ohio State number one and Notre Dame number two, because I wasn't projecting schedules. I was projecting the best teams.
This is the problem that we're going to run into all season. Again, I'm we're as guilty of it.
Don't address anybody. It. Don't address the playoffs.
Well, that's exactly my point. I mean, we want to get ahead of ourselves so much. The reason I doubt that I bring up the wide receivers is I don't know if there's a skill set among the older guys that'll be ready to play that would be good enough to lead them through the playoffs. But
we thought Mylon Graham had that skill set before August 10th.
I agree, and that's one of the first guys I mentioned. He does have that skill set, but he has to develop, and he needs to develop here in September so he can hit the ground running over the rest of the season. But we're all guilty of getting ahead of ourselves. They play Rice this week, play good defense against option football, offense. Ahead of ourselves.
Evaluating Rice, but
no, and then you play two Big Ten teams that are the lower echelon of the Big Ten, but Michigan State has a reputation of being physical, and Purdue to some extent. Just I mean, I think it's worth pointing out the shortcomings because that's what we do. But I don't want to, I don't think we need to stress about the playoffs yet when you have a whole bunch of games to play in between.
Question number six from A. Smith 2021. Any chance we will see Notre Dame with more three or four wide receiver sets at some point this year in a meaningful game? Again, not pretending I know more than the coaches, but just as a change of pace. I fully believe that 12 personnel, which is two tights, should be the base, but something to make the corners and safeties play honest in one of those other looks. Pete, let's start with you, please.
I mean, their base is three receivers.
Their base is three receivers.
Yeah, their base is not 12 personnel. 12 personnel is a changeup. They probably did a little bit more against Wisconsin than I would have expected.
First half, Pete, but I'll let you go on here.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, I mean, and they were, but you're, if you're backed up at your goal line, you don't need to come out in 11 personnel. So that was a little bit interesting to me, but it's, they're going to force the issue, I think, with Greathouse and or Graham probably starting this weekend, just in terms of how they're used in their sets. So, but four receivers, they never do it, so I don't know why they would start. And especially when your running backs can catch the ball, you don't need to do it. Also, I don't know, like, who would the fourth receiver? Is the fourth receiver better than a running back or the tight end? I would say no.
Tim?
First half was 26, 11 personnel, 5 snaps in 12 personnel, and 2 snaps in 13 because they were backed up to the goal line and decided to do that. I didn't do the second half yet. It'll be a little more 12 because they were running them to death. So obviously when you're running a team to death and ahead by 20, they're probably doing that. But no, Pete, I don't know. So that's the key. Is the fourth receiver better? Because the fourth receiver right now, I guess in our minds, is Greathouse.
Yeah, I mean, it's Greathouse. Or it's, the fourth receiver is the slot receiver. So it, whether that's Greathouse or Graham, I don't know. They don't have anybody else to trot out there. I mean, that was like, we get this depth chart last week that includes Elijah Burris and Matt Jeffrey, and they don't see the field at all. So that is a tell about how much receiver depth they actually have.
This is another question where my answer to it is, like, the question is, will they run more three? They won't run four, like Pete said. Will they run more three wide receivers if the wide receivers develop? If that's, if that gives you the best personnel on the field, then you'll see it more. But I mean, Denbrock loves his two tight ends. He loves his two tight ends.
I don't know, though. He did it 5 times in a whole half.
Well,
he loves it a lot less than the.
I'm not saying it based upon what he did Saturday. I'm saying he loves his tight ends.
I think
those two tight ends.
I think he did it less. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. He likes those two guys. Yeah. Left here, too. Yeah. He does like the Flanagan company.
Yes. Question from Tanuta Want Blitz. I love it. Is that why you gave me that question? Because it's a Tanuta question?
Yes.
Thanks, Tim. Give me your top 5 defensive players from Sunday night. I'd like to keep track for my own end season rankings, and I feel like I can do the offense myself.
I like that, too.
I like it. All right.
I mean, most people, other than the offensive line, you can do that.
All right. More from you, Tanuta Want Blitz.
My top defensive player. Oh, go ahead, Pete.
I mean, I've got 4, and then I would hear arguments for who would be number 5, but Lettermore 1, Bryce Young 2, Adon Shuler 3, Drake Bowen 4. You can go wherever you want to go for number 5.
I was with you, so go ahead, JB.
I've got Francis Brew as my number 5 and agree strongly with your others there. I think you can make a pretty good argument for Drake Bowen. I thought he got better as the game went along. Certainly led the team in tackles, but Leonard Moore, to me, you know, he's Leonard Moore. He locks down a whole half of the field. Adon Shuler in this game is my number 1 for the way he played and the passion that we saw him play with and the heavy heart that he was playing with. But Francis Brew is my number 5. He whipped some dudes on blocks and just showed you like what you've truly been missing on the interior of Notre Dame's defensive line. And that's not to take away from Teon Gray, because he'd probably be number 6.
I had the same first 4 as Pete. And then I might want to give McKinney a little credit. He did score 7 points for Notre Dame and make a nice play other than the one missed tackle. But I think they might have been able to get Leonard Moore on that one cool bunch play where they got McKinney to miss diving in space. That was one of the best designs I've seen in a long time. You know who I got to stick up for a little bit, because he had 2 tackles for loss and really a 3rd by drawing a 10-yard holding penalty, was Traore. Bubakar Traore had two tackles for loss and a sack, and he drew a 10-yard holding penalty on the flat. I mean,
yeah, I mean, he put a spin move on their right tackle that almost ended in Leonard Moore's spectacular interception was an interception. Like, that's the reason that ball came out so quickly is Bubakar Traore like spun off this dude and was in Colton Joseph's face immediately.
Yeah, I probably overreacted on Bubakar Traore. And at one point, admittedly, I know people are saying that. At one point, I mean, I just thought that he continued to get stymied for a period of time by a right tackle who was injured all last year and was injured through camp. But I underestimated his performance, and I wanted to acknowledge that. Needless to say, I got more than five, but I will limit it to five. Clearly, Shuler was tremendous. I'd put Moore in there, Bowen, Bryce Young, and then a toss-up after that. JB, I'm glad you mentioned Teon Gray. He had 18 snaps and four stops. I thought he was impactful. He was a guy, I said this on Monday, that when you come to the line, when you're a running back and you come to the point of attack at the line of scrimmage and you see that big dude, you're not going to try to run through him. You're going to try to run around him, and then your team defense rallies to it. But Osbury makes seven tackles, and it's always done anonymously. He's just a really, really good football player that's always around football. Francis Brew, who's a difference maker, will move into the starting lineup this week.
Our next question from Winamac Jack. Name a player who did not play Sunday or barely played that you'd most like to see play against Michigan State. Don't use Rice, because I know that whoever you answer will play against Rice.
Jonas Walton for me.
Yeah, me too. Sorry.
Yeah, it'd be high. I mean, Joey O'Brien played one snap, so for the sake of being different, I'll go with him. But Jonas Walton was the first name I wrote down.
As it was for me, you know, now I'd like to see all these guys against Rice first as well, because we'll start to get an idea of what, like, Walton can do. But, yeah, I think that's, like, you're looking for, okay, how can you spice up the offense? You need a guy who brings the best combination of size, speed, and elusiveness. It's Jonas Walton. At least we think it is, based upon what we've seen in practice and then the glowing report that we got from Jaywan Sider a few weeks ago. So he would be at the top of the list. I want to see Matt Jeffrey in action, because I think he can be helpful to the offense periodically, not somebody that you necessarily feature. Ethan Long would be another guy that I would suggest, because he's probably going to have to, either him or Joey O'Brien. I'm not sure who's going to go in first. Joey O'Brien was listed ahead of him, though, right, on the depth chart last week?
They're both on the depth chart.
They're both on it this week, yeah.
Walton's my choice on offense, but my choice for the football team against Michigan State is Kingston Viliamuasa, because I'd rather see an All-American play than a guy that might get six carries this year. But Jonas Walton would be a little surprising. You might be able to get that burst where you thought you could have a Jonas Walton day where you're like, oh, so he couldn't have played the previous game, huh? Like we do that with Darius Walker back in the day. You couldn't get that guy a couple handoffs. That's what... Hopefully that's that type of talent that Sider was talking about, where maybe you didn't need to rest him, not rest him, maybe you didn't need to hold him back for a couple of games.
And Walton's an example of it. The conversation that we had with Nolan James yesterday about, you know, he felt like he was going too fast. And the phrase he used was slow to fast through, slow to the hole, deciding what you're going to do, and then go fast through it. I think Walton will probably experience the same thing the first time he gets in, which is probably this weekend. So get him in so he can get that out of his system, adapt to the pace of the game, and then be ready, you know, be up to speed to where you want him for Michigan State.
Final question is a two-parter from JJ Elwine. First, he wants to know, with a number of Notre Dame blowouts ahead, what should I tell my wife when she asks me, why do I need to watch the rest of the game with Notre Dame up 40 in the second half? What do I need to see, and why can't I mow the lawn instead? Do you have any advice, JB?
I do have advice there. I have the perfect answer, actually. When Notre Dame is in these blowouts, you have to continue to watch through the duration of the contest, because you're telling your wife you're making your decisions based on 2027 travel, and you need to see these players to understand what kind of nucleus Notre Dame's going to have next year to justify your travel expenses. So you're welcome. There's no other acceptable answer.
I thought you were going to say that you're going to tell your wife that you're going to take her on the road with you to the games.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. Fair enough.
Yeah. That's how you get her to engage with you. But really, it's about how are you allocating your household money? And baby, I need to make sure that I'm not wasting our hard-earned money. You do too much for us around this place. You're the CEO of our family, honey, but we need to see this.
John, I feel like you have some personal experience here or something. I don't know. You seem so intense about that answer.
No, my wife is a superstar, so.
Just
The next question is, since I think JB handled that one, and he's apparently asking JJ L1 to lie. The next question comes from Barry on a Bender. After kickoff, you will stop worrying about an NIU-type debacle after you see what against Rice, Pete Sampson?
They're up 14-0 in the first quarter. I mean, that's it. These games, I feel like when they go sideways, it's not because the defense didn't show up.
Right.
It's because the offense was a disaster. And I have a hard time seeing that happening. So I would expect, you'll be able to be calm, cool, and collected, you know, watching this game on TV. There will be no reason to freak out. You'd be very stoic about your fandom on Saturday, because probably by early in the second quarter, you'll know the end result ahead of time.
Notre Dame will rush of their 75 yards in their opening drive for a touchdown. 60 will be on the ground. They'll establish a line of scrimmage, yes. and they'll maintain that.
I use way too many words just to describe O'Malley's second touchdown rule.
Yeah, second touchdown rule is ending this game when Notre Dame scores a second touchdown. But if Rice does, Notre Dame will still win because they have CJ Carr, not inaccurate quarterbacks. You know, that is the reason they lost those games, is the offensive line. But they almost lost to Toledo, the quarterback when they lost to Marshall, and the quarterback play, not the quarterback, but the quarterback play when they lost to Northern Illinois.
Vanderbilt,
the quarterback play. They replaced him. This is how the Ball State was close, because the quarterback play. That will not happen with CJ Carr. You'll be fine. I'll start with predictions because of that. I never get to go first, and I always have to complain that someone stole my number. So no matter how many points I think Notre Dame is going to score and how good they might look and how many passes they might throw, I am never again betting Notre Dame to cover the spread in week two. Notre Dame 44, Rice nothing. 44 and a half line.
That was some maladroit behavior to introduce that question and then let yourself go first, you jerk.
Not a question. It's a new segment.
52-3. 52-3.
Yeah, I'm going 55-7. I think it'll be a cover. It's a lot of points. But Rice gives up a lot of points, so really shouldn't be too much of an issue. I would expect CJ Carr to CJ Carr's box score will be like, ooh, that was a nice, 337 yard, 4 touchdown performance, no interceptions.
17 for 20.
Yeah. And then we'll get a 45 yard Jonas Walton touchdown run in the second half. So everyone will go home happy on this one.
For the record, Sampson and I did predict the exact same score, and I don't change mine. If that's what it is, that's what it is. He just said a number that is eerily close to what I'm ultimately going to predict in tomorrow's preview. Tio, I know you said I could go ahead and reveal it since it's Rice, but we'll wait until tomorrow. But can Ja'Kari Brown cause enough trouble to score a touchdown for Rice? I think he probably can. Again, with the notion in mind that you're going to have two new defensive ends playing against us, and there may be some busts along the way, but a lot of points for Notre Dame and not a whole lot for Rice.
Dying to do 52-0, but I'm never picking the cover again. Just happens too often. Although when they cover, they play a terrible team, so maybe it's humanly possible. You're like, yeah, I don't think East Tennessee State had a line against Notre Dame back in 2023. Yeah, I almost forgot that game happened, guys. Was it Tennessee State or East Tennessee State? JB would know.
Tennessee State.
Tennessee State. Yes. East Tennessee State's good at basketball once in a while, right?
Yeah, and East Tennessee State playing future Notre Dame opponent North Carolina this weekend. A little bit of bonus knowledge for you there. That's what I do.
That's what we're all coming for. And we hope you guys come see us, our Irish Illustrated Instant Analysis, maybe Pete Sampson's Athletic Podcast. John Bryce, where are you this weekend?
I am at Arkansas, Utah, so fired up for that.
That's Purdue on defense. Let me know how that goes with those guys.
Yeah, I've spent some time with Morgan Scalley, the Utah head coach. They're doing like a 500 drone show over the stadium Saturday night under the lights. It's a late one, though. Kickoff is 8:15 Mountain Time, so you boys will be ensconced in your beds by the time I'm still working.
Well, we'll be watching Texas and Ohio State, but you enjoy that other game. I think it should be good times. We will finish off with Rice, and before that, we will have some Irish Illustrated Instant Analysis from Notre Dame Stadium. For John Bryce, USA Today, Pete Sampson, The Athletic, and Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated, I'm Tim O'Malley. Thanks for watching and listening, Irish Illustrated Insider.